The ancient world has opened up before our eyes over the last two centuries now. And the story of the opening of the ancient world to the modern world, to our understanding, has its own interest, and a special interest for Seventh-day Adventists. Now, Seventh-day Adventists are very much into dates and history. And that's good, because it shows that we are tied to concrete facts that are real, that people can really get a hold of. And if there's anything you can get a hold of from the biblical world, it's archaeology. You've got the tangible evidence right in your hand. I have been over digging a few times. I've taken tour groups over there. I must confess that I like taking tour groups better than digging. The life of the archaeologist is a rather hard one. You get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. You're on the bus by 4:30. You're at the work site by 5. And you work until about 10. And then you take a short break. And then you work until about 12:30. And then you knock off for the rest of the day. There's a good reason for that. Because it's hot. And so the idea is to get your work in the field done while it's still cool. And so that's why you get out there and start work at 5 o'clock in the morning. The archaeologist has certain tools, and those tools are getting more, amplified, a broader variety, a broader capability, more technology. We're taking computers into the field now. Now, that proved to be a little bit of a problem at the beginning, because in the Middle East, the current, the electrical current, is a little irregular. And so we have burned out more than one computers on this irregular current. But now that problem is solved, and the computers work just fine. And so much of the data that the archaeologist digs up can be registered right on the site. Now, I'm going to tell you a little bit about the development of archaeology in Egypt and in Mesopotamia and then in Israel, because those are the countries that we will be looking at in the pictures during this week. So let's start with Egypt. Talk just a little bit about how Egypt came to be opened up to the modern world. Now, of course, everybody knew Egypt was there. The knowledge of where Egypt was and that there were ancient monuments there were never lost. But they really were never studied carefully until the year 1798. Now, we look at that date prophetically, don't we? We see the great prophecy of the 1260 days ending in 1798, and that is correct. In fact, the two events of the conclusion of the 1260-day prophecy and the opening of ancient Egypt occurred virtually simultaneously. How did that happen? Well, the French army had marched down south through the Italian peninsula as far as Rome under the direction of General Napoleon Bonaparte. And when they came to besiege the city of Rome, and more specifically the Vatican City, Napoleon was called away by the French Parliament. And so he left the French army besieging the Vatican City in charge of General Berthier. But Napoleon was called by the French Parliament to go to the north coast of France to study the problem to see whether it was feasible to invade England at that time. So he was called away from the siege of the Vatican City to study this problem in northern France. He did study the problem, and he concluded that the invasion of England was not feasible at that particular time. So he turned his attention towards another project. He went down to the south of France. He assembled a navy. He put the army on board those ships and sailed for Egypt. But at the same time, he took a group of special people along. He not only took the core of his army, he took a core of 120 scholars. And while Napoleon's army was conquering Egypt, Napoleon's scholars were going up and down the Nile Valley copying the ancient monuments. And so these 120 scholars from France fanned out across ancient Egypt, drawing, painting pictures of the ancient Egyptian monuments. And when they got back to France, they published the results of their explorations in the Nile Valley. And the results of those explorations filled 10 volumes. 10 large folio volumes. So the year 1798 is significant for two major events. The conclusion of the great 1260-day prophecy when the Pope was taken prisoner by General Berthier, and the opening of ancient Egypt by the scholars that Napoleon took to Egypt to study all the monuments of ancient Egypt. Now, at this time, they could not read Egyptian hieroglyphs. But when the volumes were published, it whetted the appetite of modern Western European scholars to learn how to study and read those ancient hieroglyphs. And the particular man who finally cracked the code was a man named Jean-François Champollion. It took him 20 years. And the key to ancient languages is when you have an ancient language given in another different ancient language. And there is a stone, a very famous stone, called the Rosetta Stone. Now, the Rosetta Stone, you might think it would be in the Louvre Museum in France. It is not. It is in the British Museum in London. Because as the French ships were sailing back from Egypt, bringing with them the riches of Egypt, which they found that they could take with them, they had on board the Rosetta Stone, which was found at a place called, of all things, Rosetta. It's in the western delta of Egypt. Now, this Rosetta Stone, historically, it's not very important. It was an inscription which a late pharaoh, actually a Greek pharaoh by this time, Ptolemy II had one of his decrees inscribed on this black diorite stone. But the key that he provided us with is that he gave it to us in three languages. And so one of the languages is the ancient hieroglyphs, and one of the languages was a form that you might call almost a shorthand of the ancient hieroglyphs. It's called Demotic. That's the late form of the Egyptian writing. It's kind of a cursive script. And in the bottom, the same decree was given in Greek. And that proved to be the key. So you have three languages: hieroglyphic Egyptian, Demotic Egyptian, which was really no help. Demotic is actually harder than the hieroglyphs. And then Greek, and that was the key. Now, Champollion looked carefully at this inscription, and what he noticed was, every now and then, there was an oval or a circle. And each time that oval or circle was repeated, there was a series of the same kind of signs in that circle, in the hieroglyphic text. And down below, he read the name of the Pharaoh in Greek as Ptolemy. So he assumed that the little circle that enclosed these special signs was a special form of the way in which the name of the Pharaoh was written. His assumption was correct. And that gave him about five or six of the early Egyptian letters. It gave him the P and the T and the L and the W and the M and another W and an S. And that was the key that unlocked, that cracked the code. Because with that he could begin to piece together other letters. Now, Champollion was a scholar of the Coptic language. Coptic is the very latest form of Egyptian. It's a form of Egyptian, a late corrupted Egyptian, that's part Greek and part Egyptian. And Champollion studied this Coptic language intensively. And with that, he learned enough Egyptian from its latest stage that now he could work back and open up the whole code for the hieroglyphs. Hieroglyphic writing is a rather complicated scheme. To write hieroglyphs as a scribe in ancient Egypt, you had to know 2,000 signs. 2,000 signs. And they had a very unusual system where a sign could stand for one letter, or it could stand for two letters, or it could stand for three letters. And they used all of them interchangeably. And so it was a very complicated writing system. Now let's think a little bit about Moses in Egypt. Obviously, when he lived in Pharaoh's house, he would have had to study hieroglyphs. And he knew how to read them and write them. Now there's an interesting little story about Moses. After he has been out in the wilderness for 40 years, God tells him to go back to Egypt. And he protests. And he says, no, I can't go back to Egypt. I can't speak. Now what did he mean? Did he mean that he had totally forgotten his knowledge of hieroglyphs or the Egyptian language? No, that's not likely. Immigrants here to the United States still remember their language from the old country 40 years later. But you see, at the Egyptian court, there was a very precise way in which people did things. And so if you were addressing a servant of yours as an official, you would speak to him in one kind of way. And if you were addressing a fellow official, you would address them in another way. And if you were addressing a superior officer, official, you would speak to them in a third way. And if you talked to Pharaoh himself, you'd talk to him in a fourth way. And so that was not just retaining a knowledge of how to speak the Egyptian language. That was the niceties of court language. And Moses had been away from that for 40 years, and that's where you lose the fine-tuning. Oh, sure, he could speak Egyptian. But he had been away from court so long that that knowledge of court language had left him. Now, there's another interesting story about Moses and writing. Critics of the late 19th century said that Moses could not have written the first five books of the Bible because the alphabet had not been invented yet. Now, you may not realize that how far back the alphabet goes, but the alphabet actually goes back to, as we now know, the very place and the very time in which Moses lived. Moses, when he escaped from Egypt, he went out to the Sinai Peninsula. And it was there that the alphabet developed. Now, the story is, the Egyptians sent expeditions out into Sinai. They did not consider Sinai as a part of Egypt in ancient times. They sent expeditions out there to work the mines. And they worked those mines to get turquoise. And some of you may have seen the beautiful pictures of the Egyptian jewelry, the pectorals, which have gold and silver and then all the precious stones, red, blue, lapis lazuli, carnelian, turquoise. So these beautiful pendants that the Egyptian used, the turquoise for those beautiful pieces of jewelry came from the mines in Sinai. And it was there that the alphabet was developed, because the Egyptians had Canaanites who worked for them, maybe as slaves, or maybe they hired them, we're not certain. But these Canaanites looked at the writing of the Egyptians, the hieroglyphs, and they said to themselves in a certain way, we can make use of those signs, but use them for our own language. The Canaanite language is very close to biblical Hebrew, but very different from Egyptian. And so someone, sometime, out there in the Sinai Peninsula, developed the idea of what is known as the Rebus Principle. Let me give you an example of how the Rebus Principle operates. If I drew a square like this, you might suggest or think that I'm drawing the picture of a house. And for ancient times, that would be correct. Now, the Hebrew and Canaanite word for a house is the word beth, beth, bait. And the first sound of that word is a B. And so if I take the picture of the square of a house, and I take the first sound from that picture, and then I make that picture stand for that letter, that's the Rebus Principle, where you take the name of an object, where you draw the object, and you take the name of the object, and you take the first sound of the name to be represented by the picture. Now, that little square, believe it or not, is the ancestor to the letter B with which you write today. Now, if you take that square, you've got to bend it in, and then you've got to rotate it. And if you do, you have a B. The alphabet was a major advance. Oh, all right. Well, let's put the alphabet on hold and see if we get any pictures. Well, that's going to be about as big as we can get it. But now we could turn out these lights up here. That might help a little bit. We're going all the way to the other end of the Fertile Crescent. This is jet age travel, you know, so we're covering 600 miles in 5 minutes. And we're going to Nineveh. The reason I'm showing these particular pictures today, or intended to, was because it's related to the book of Daniel. And the morning class is in the book of Daniel. And so Daniel, of course, lived in Babylon, and Babylon was closely associated with Assyria. So half of these slides are about Assyria, and half of these slides are about Babylon. So we'll go through these. This is the mound of Assyria. Nineveh, the city of Nineveh, the capital of ancient Assyria. This city is mentioned in something like 6 or 7 books of the Old Testament. Isaiah, Micah, Nahum. What are some of the others? I mentioned Isaiah. Jonah, of course. And you'll get an idea of the problem that Jonah had to deal with when we look at this city. Now, you'll notice it looks like a mound. It looks like a hill. That is not a natural mound or hill. That is an artificial mound which has been built up through time. As people lived there, they built up the city like a layer cake. And they'd live in one level, and then it would be destroyed. And they'd build again, and then it would be destroyed. And so you go through a layer cake of 18 to 20 different levels of, as you go through 1,500 years of history. And you'll notice there's a cut right through the middle. That's a river. There's a Kozer River, which joins the Tigris River just this side of this ancient mound. So here is an ancient mound, an ancient hill, if you please, that has been built up through time, and it has been cut through by a natural river. And to show you how deep that cut has been made, this shows you the cut. And if you could come a little closer, you could perhaps see some people working, archaeologists working down in the base of the natural gorge of the river. This is the University of California expedition in 1989, just before the Gulf War of 1991, and this was the last time archaeologists from America were able to get into Iraq. And this is just another picture of these archaeologists working way down in the bottom of this gorge. And this is the most ancient portion of Nineveh. Nineveh is a very ancient city. You may recall that it's listed in the Table of Nations in Genesis 10. So Nineveh already shows up at a very early period, and this is down deep in the 3rd millennium B.C. to which Genesis 10 applies. And here's looking down the gorge out into the plain of the valley, and the Tigris River is on beyond at the very top of the scene. Sorry you can't see this too well, but this is the wall of the ancient city. And this has been reconstructed by the Department of Antiquities. When the archaeologist starts working, he doesn't find a full intact wall or a full intact gate. He finds only the stumps of the wall. And so they reconstruct the wall, partly using ancient texts which tell them something about the ancient city. And they have built this wall up. They do know that the towers were there, and they know that those towers protruded out from the wall of the city. And so this is a reconstruction based on what was found at the base of these walls, showing what the walls of ancient Nineveh looked like. And this is another reconstructed gate. I'm sorry you can't see it clearly enough, but if you could see it in a little darker situation, this one is not made out of limestone blocks. This one is made out of mud bricks. And the mud bricks actually were used to form that arch that you can see in the center. And so this, too, has been reconstructed from what the ancient gates and walls of Nineveh were like. This is the remains of a palace. And you may see that on each side there is some walls and there's some sheeting, galvanized sheeting at the top. That is not part of the ancient palace. What is part of the ancient palace, you may see there are little pieces along the wall. Those originally were murals or carved reliefs that were set in the wall. And so the king, this happened to be Sennacherib's palace, and Sennacherib is mentioned in 2 Kings 18 and 19. So he's the king who is mentioned in the Bible. And this king, Sennacherib, built this palace, and when it was built, it was the biggest palace in the ancient world. And so he gave it a name which represented that, and he called it the Palace Without a Rival. In other words, no other palace was as big as my palace. And in each of the halls and the walls of the rooms, he put these carved pictures, these carved reliefs. And here you can see just the stumps of the remains of those. So the Assyrian craftsmen went to work, and here, maybe some of you in the center can see a little straighter on, you can see the carvings of figures on these. These are not from Nineveh. This is from another city nearby. And these carvings are representations of the officials as they stand before the king. And then they have something else there which looks like an angel. It was the Assyrian version of an angel. And they have wings, and they have a little incense basket or burner that they are holding before the king as prayers for the king go up to the gods. And so this is the type of art. Here's one of these so-called angels. The Assyrians, of course, had a different name for them. But he has the little basket with the coals and the incense, and he has his hand lifted in blessing before the king. And you'll notice he has kind of a human-like visage. It's a mixed figure. Now, Sennacherib built this city of Nineveh to a huge size. And the city was smaller before his time. Now, when you expand a city like that, you need more water. And so to get water, they went up to the mountains and built an aqueduct. And the light line that you see at the top is the aqueduct that brought water to the city of Nineveh more than 30 miles away. And here you see the blocks. This is the aqueduct. This is the tunnel of the aqueduct through which the water would run that would go down to supply water to the city of Nineveh. And of course, every king had to put his signature on his accomplishments. And so here you see a stone disc with cuneiform or wedge-shaped writing on it, which has the name of Sennacherib. And Sennacherib is praising his own great achievements here. Now, you may remember his story in 2 Kings 18 and 19. It is repeated again in the book of Isaiah, chapter 36 to 39, and it is the story of how he was not able to conquer the city of Jerusalem. That Isaiah the prophet went to Hezekiah the king and told him, Sennacherib will not set foot in this city. God has said so. And indeed, Sennacherib himself never claimed to have conquered Jerusalem, although he mentions the campaign to Judah. Now, this is a temple. You can see, at least if you can see a little bit, you can see the rooms. And in the back room, you'll notice about the platform on the back is higher. And that's because that is where the statue of the god stood. So there's a certain similarity with the Hebrew temple. You have a holy place, you have a courtyard, and then a holy place, and a most holy place. Now, there are several different ways in which you could build temples in the ancient world, but this long axis type of temple is one, and it's a somewhat general parallel to the way Solomon built his temple. And here you see the most holy place, the platform with the steps going up to it where the statue of the god would stand. But there's a distinct difference. In Assyria, if you were a worshiper here, you could go in and stand before this god and make your request here. You didn't do that in Jerusalem. In Jerusalem, you worshiped outside the temple. And the priests were the ones who went inside the temple. It's a difference in the conception of God. In the Israelite temple, God was never represented by a figure like an idol or a statue. It is his own resplendent, glorious presence that was there as the Shekinah. And this is so magnificent, so transcendent, that the worshipers worshipped outside of the building where the personal presence of God was represented. And this is an incense altar with a little better lighting. You might see the horns on the corners of the top of the incense altar. And here's a round incense altar, another way on which to do your worshiping with by burning incense there. Now here is the slide that I wanted to show for the Daniel class this morning. This is a school. And so you can see there are benches and then there are tables. The tables are to the far left. The benches are in the right center, a left center. Then the other benches are in the right center, and then the tables are on the right side outside there. And so the students, like Daniel and like his three friends, would sit. This is in Assyria, of course. This is not in Babylon, but it's a good example. They would sit on these benches and they would work on these tables. And that is where they learned to write the cuneiform writing with the clay, with the wooden stylus that made the wedges in the writing. So here you can see the Assyrian students at school. This is the gate and wall along the south end of the city of Nineveh. And the University of California expedition was clearing that wall. And so as they cleared that wall, they came to these large blocks, which lined the inside of the wall. And then they dug down to the foundation. And this is about 10 to 12 feet down. And this is only the stumps of the walls. Now this is real. This is all. None of this is reconstructed. The city was destroyed in the year 612. And these walls were covered up by the winds of the desert. And they were left there in this form and shape until the archaeologists uncovered them just a decade or so ago. And so this is just the stumps of the walls. The superstructure of the walls is, of course, gone. Had tumbled in and been knocked down and so forth. So here are the workmen working away with their director. And one of the things that you find, I doubt that you can see it, but in the right upper corner there's a little black square. And that little black square is a special box in which an idol was placed. And in this picture, if you could see it a little more clearly, you might see the idol. And it's actually, there he is in the hand of the excavator. It's the head of a lion and the body of a man. And so when the Assyrians built this wall, they dedicated this wall, and they dedicated it to this god, and this god was supposed to be the protector of this wall and of this city. But that god of that protection didn't do his job. So when the Medes and the Babylonians came to Nineveh in the year 612, they overran the city, they overran the walls, and they conquered the city. And this is what is described in the book of Nahum, the conquest of Assyria. And we may have a slide that's stuck there. New lens, okay? Maybe we'll get a bigger picture out of the deal. What we find here, this is Connie Gain, who teaches at Andrews University, and she is clearing... She is clearing skeletons. Now, these are not skeletons in a cemetery. These are skeletons at the base of a city wall. And what are they doing there? They were soldiers. They were soldiers who fought on this wall, Assyrian soldiers who fought against the Medes and the Babylonians that were coming in from the outside. And they fell in battle here. And so here, maybe you can see the man's ribs up at the top. No, that's his arm. It's up over his head like this. Then right where the pick of her hand points is the teeth of the skull. So these are the skeletons of Assyrian soldiers who died in battle defending their city of Nineveh. But the prophetic word had decreed that the time of Nineveh's end had come, and these soldiers then demonstrate the fall of that city. Now, the fall of that city was predicted by another prophet, but the Lord told him that the city wasn't going to be destroyed exactly when he thought it was going to be destroyed. And that's the story of Jonah. Now, the Muslims who live in this area today, in the city of Mosul, which is just across the river from ancient Nineveh, have built a mosque, and this mosque has a name. And the mosque is actually on a part of the old mound of Nineveh. And the name of the mosque is Nebi Yunus. And if you think a little bit about those two words, Nebi is the Hebrew word Navi, which is the word for prophet. And so you can probably make out the word Yunus, which is the word for Jonah. The prophet Jonah. So the Muslim tradition, not the Christian tradition, the Muslim tradition is that the prophet Jonah is buried here. Now, we don't know that that's true. That could be just folk tradition or tradition which is built up around the site. But for whatever reason, the Muslims have the tradition of the prophet Jonah, and they have a building there at Nineveh dedicated to him today. We're moving south now. This is a story of two cities, Nineveh in the north and Babylon in the south. And they're about a little over 200 miles apart. And when Nineveh was strong, Babylon was weak. And when Babylon was strong, Nineveh was weak. And so, when Nineveh came to an end, as I just showed you, with those soldiers who fell in the last battle for Nineveh, Babylon was on the rise. And Babylon became the new great power of the ancient world right in the time of Daniel, right in the time of Jeremiah. Now, this is a map of the ancient city of Babylon, and I should talk just a little bit about the size of ancient cities. Nineveh was the largest ancient city. It covered 1,800 acres. Babylon, which you see here, was the next largest ancient city, and it covered about 1,400 acres. To give you a comparison and a scale, Jerusalem of the same time was about 80 acres. 80 acres for Jerusalem, 1,400 acres for Babylon. So when Daniel and his three friends arrived here, they undoubtedly were impressed by the huge size and nature of this city. Now there is an old city of Babylon, and that is the square in the middle. And if you can read any of the writing, it says inner city. That is a mile square. Then you'll notice a large triangular wall around the outside, and it takes in about 6 or 7 miles of going around those outer walls. Those outer walls, if you could read the writing, which you probably can't, says Nebuchadnezzar's Eastern New Quarter. Those new walls were put there, built there by Nebuchadnezzar. Now he had plenty of time and opportunity to do that because he ruled as a king for 43 years. So he was a long-lived king, he was a powerful king, and he was a king who was noted for his building accomplishments. Now that plays a part in a biblical story. Daniel chapter 4, Nebuchadnezzar has already been given the prophecy about his humiliation, but he doesn't repent. You know, Daniel says, now, it may be that when you hear this word from the Lord, that you may change your heart and God may change his heart. But Nebuchadnezzar didn't change his heart, so the judgment fell on him 12 months later as he's walking on the roof of the palace. Now, the palace is right in the northwest corner, right along the river. Some of you might be able to read the word palaces. That's the corner, and on the roof of one of those buildings, Nebuchadnezzar was walking, and he was looking out over all this. And he looked out over it all, and he says, "Is this not great Babylon which I have built?" Pride, hubris. The evidence for him building that city is found on the building blocks of which the buildings and the walls are composed, because they are stamped with the name of Nebuchadnezzar. There were literally millions of bricks stamped with the name of Nebuchadnezzar. And so we know this is not a totally false claim. It's not the problem of the claim being true. It's the problem of the pride, the overweening pride which he took in his accomplishments. And he did it at the expense of captive peoples also, like the Jews. So, we have the inner city, a mile square, the outer city, 6 or 7 miles around, and the Euphrates River. And you may remember the famous story about the capture of Babylon by the Persians. And the story of the capture of Babylon by the Persians is the story of a stratagem. This was a well and strongly defended city, as I will show you in a minute. To have attempted to penetrate the walls, the Persians would have had to go through 7 walls, each of them 20 to 30 feet thick. 7 walls. You'll never make it. You'll never get through those walls. You have to get into the city through a trick, through a stratagem. And the stratagem was, as you know the story so well, they diverted the river. They marched down the dry riverbed, and they got into the city through the gates that were on the riverbank going into the city. Now, even that requires a little accomplishment, because in normal times, those gates would have been guarded. But the night that the city of Babylon fell, something went wrong, or something very unusual happened. And so people have wondered, how did the Persians get inside the city? I mean, even if you come down the riverbed, you still have to get into the gates, into the city. Well, they wouldn't have been as well defended. But remember what happened in the city that night. Daniel chapter 5 tells the night the city fell, and what happened in the palace the night the city fell. Writing on the wall. Handwriting on the wall. Meeni, meeni, tekel, upharsin. You've been weighed in the balances and found wanting, and your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. Now, if there was the hand of God or the hand of an angel that wrote on that wall, it may just be that the hand of the angel unlocked the gates to let the Persian troops in too. Because there is a prophecy in Isaiah which says to Cyrus, a prophecy to Cyrus, the Persian king, by Isaiah a century and a half earlier, which says, I will open before you the two-leaved gates. So maybe we have a manifestation of the power of God even in opening this city to the conquering Persians. Well, here's a map. It's an ancient map. You can see the cuneiform writing down at the bottom. And this is the Babylonian conception of the world. It's a flat disc. It has little star pointers out at the side. And right at the center of the world is the Euphrates River. And right at the center of the Euphrates River is the city of Babylon. And so the Babylonians had the same conception about the center of the world as the Romans did. You know, the Romans considered Rome to be the umbilicus or the navel of the world. And so the Babylonians considered Babylon to be the center of the world. Now here are the walls. At the bottom, you see the outer walls of Babylon. And actually, there are four walls there. There's a separate wall, and then there's a thinner wall, and then there's a double wall. Four walls that went around that 6 or 7 mile expanse. Then if you get through that, if you just happen to be able to get through that, you'd come to the walls at the top on the map. And here you see a solid single wall, and then a solid double wall. Three more walls. So to get into the inner city of Babylon, where the palace was, if you were just taking it by main strength and awkwardness, you'd have to get through seven walls, or the gates of seven walls. And these walls were all defended. There were troops on the tops of those walls. And you'd have to fight your way through the walls, or over the walls, or under the walls, or some way around those walls. Now, the main gate into the city, from the north, has a great processional way. And these are the bricks. I'm sorry that you can't see them very clearly. They're beautiful enamel-colored bricks. And this presents a very beautiful geometric design. And it has in these bricks animals, pictures of animals. And so here's the gate itself. The former picture was the processional way leading up to the gate. This is the great Ishtar Gate of Babylon. These bricks are not in Iraq today. They are in Berlin, in East Berlin, in Germany. The Germans, under a man named Kaldewey, worked at the city of Babylon for 10 years. Now, I mentioned how an archaeologist digs today. But the archaeologist today just goes over to the Middle East for 6 or 8 weeks. Robert Kaldewey, when he worked here, he lived there all year round and worked there every day, working day, on this ancient city as he dug it up. And so he is the one who excavated these beautiful enameled bricks. So he shipped them back to Berlin and had the gate of ancient Babylon reconstructed in the museum of East Berlin, the Western Asiatic Museum in East Berlin. Now, here's one of these lions. If you remember your prophetic symbols from Daniel chapter 7, what is the symbol used for Babylon? A lion. And here's the lion of Babylon. Now this, from the tip of his tail to the tip of his nose is about 6 feet. And it isn't just that the Babylonians were nature lovers, that they wanted to depict these animals. It has theology behind it. Because you see, their conception was that on the back of this animal rode one of the gods. And each god had his own symbol or his own animal upon which to ride. And this god, the god who rode on the lion, was Ishtar. Ishtar, the god of love and war. The goddess of love and war. And so then we have the bull. And again, this is about 5 or 6 feet. And the bull carried the god Hadad. You may know him in the Bible in the West as Baal. Baal was the storm god who brought the rains and who brought the water that fertilized the fields and made the crops grow. So the bull is the symbol of the god Hadad, who is thought of as riding on his back. Now this is not the entryway to the city gate, and this is not the city gate. This is the entryway to the palace. And once again, you have these geometric designs, these beautiful geometric designs. But I want you to notice the palace across, I mean the line across, of animals across the bottom, if you can see them. Can you see them well enough? What do you see? Lions! Again! That's right. And so, this actually was on the outside of the palace audience chamber, where the king held his court. And so the inside wall was a plain white plaster, but the outside wall was these beautiful enameled bricks. So you were to be impressed by the power of the king as you came into this part of the palace. Now this is what's left in Babylon today of the Ishtar Gate and the processional way. And these are plain bricks. These are not the colored enameled bricks that originally lay on top of these. And again, you can see the animals that are there. And here is another one. Now what do you see? Well, I don't expect you to get it because it's not a normal, natural animal. This is a dragon. And the dragon consists of about 4 elements. It has the head of a serpent. It has the body of a fish. It has the legs of an eagle. You can see the talons, the claws. And it has the tail of a scorpion. This is a composite beast made up of different features taken from different animals. Now then, think again about Daniel 7. The lion represents Babylon, right? What's the next beast? The bear, which represents what? Medo-Persia. And the next beast is the leopard, which represents what? Greece. And the next beast is? Nondescript beast. Why was it a nondescript beast? Let me suggest it was a nondescript beast because it was a composite beast that was made up of different parts of lions and bears and what have you. In fact, if you look at Revelation 13, you'll see the beast, the land beast there, has parts of a leopard and part of a lion and part of a bear. Composite beast. Now, this suggests to me that when God spoke to Daniel, and he said, use these symbols for these nations in this prophecy. You can use symbols that you see on the walls of these cities that are being represented by the symbols. That God spoke to Daniel in a language and in an art and in a symbol that was appropriate to his time. Now, if he spoke in our time, maybe he'd speak to us with satellites or computers or what have you. But in Daniel's time, he spoke with these symbols that were appropriate to what he knew. And here's what the processional way of the Ishtar Gate looked like today in Babylon. And you can see the walls have been reconstructed in part on the sides. And you can see how wide the space was, the passageway into the city. And so if you were a prisoner, like Daniel, coming to this city, entering the city, You would be impressed. I would be impressed. I was impressed. This is a wide expanse of a highway. Now, if you go to ancient cities today, if you go to Old Jerusalem, the old city, the streets are very narrow. Not so the great processional way. Because this was where the king paraded his army, and this is where the gods came in procession at the time of the New Year's festival. So Daniel looked at all this. He probably went in and out of this gate many, 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 many times in his lifetime. Here is an artist's conception of the king arriving back with the army, entering the Ishtar gate. And if you could see a little more clearly, if you follow up that highway and you look off to the right, you'll see what looks like a forest. And that is the artist's conception of the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. Hanging Gardens of Babylon. And so, as you came from the north, you went through the gate, you went a little farther ways down, and you turned right, and you went into the palace area. And you probably remember the story, the famous story of the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. It was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. Well, how did the Hanging Gardens of Babylon get started? It got started because of a political alliance. And the political alliance was between Babylon and the Medes. Now, the Medes lived in the mountains of northern Iran. And the Babylonians lived in the south of Mesopotamian plain. And so these two got together, and they attacked Nineveh and overthrew Assyria. And then what you do then is you cement this political bonding in what's known as a covenant, and you seal that covenant by marrying the royal princess of one royal house to the crown prince of the other royal house, a royal marriage. And so Nebuchadnezzar was married to a princess of the Medes. So when she came to live here, she said, "I don't want to live here. I don't like this. This does not remind me of home at all. I need some trees around here. I need some greenery, some shrubbery." And so Nebuchadnezzar, as a courtesy to his wife, and the petition of his wife, built the famous Hanging Gardens of Babylon to remind her of what the mountains of Media were like. And so that's the romantic story back of the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. This is a picture which was taken in 1989 of work going on at the palace of ancient Babylon. There was restoration work that was taking place here. Since the Gulf War, I don't know if that work has continued. I think it probably has. The German archaeologists, are still able to get into the country of Iran, and I think they are continuing the restoration work. Now, one of the questions that comes up is, were any archaeological sites damaged during the Gulf War? The answer is no. Babylon was not hit by any bombs or rockets. City of Ur, the Iraqi Army Air Force had airplanes stationed near the city, ancient city of Ur, but it was untouched, unscathed. So the ancient monuments of Babylonia have survived and are still being reconstructed today. Now another question that comes up is, isn't it true that Ezekiel prophesies about Babylon being desolate and just a hold for birds and uninhabited? Is Babylon today inhabited? The answer is no. What this is being built is as a museum for tourists to come and see. There is one person who lives in ancient Babylon today, and that's the night watchman. But this is not being rebuilt as a city for people to live in. This is being rebuilt as a museum to demonstrate the glory of the antiquities of ancient Babylon. Well, this city was full of temples. There were gods many. And this is just a review of some temples. Here's one This is the temple of Ninma. This is the birth goddess. If you were pregnant and wanted to make sure that you had a good delivery, you would go and worship in this shrine. You see, the idea of the pagans was that nature is composed of all these forces, and each one of these forces of nature is under the control of the god, each one of the gods. And so if you keep all those gods happy, you can keep nature on your side. But the true God says, all of those forces of nature are under my control. We worship the God of creation. We worship the God of creation on the memorial day of His creation. He has power over that creation. So you don't need to go to the temple of the birth goddess to make sure that you had a good birth. This is another temple, also inside the city of Babylon. And this one is of some interest because if you look on the left side, you'll see that there are three little rooms, and each one of those little rooms has a platform which has a P on it. And that P is the location or the platform where the idol of the god was placed. And so that means there were three. And so what there really was here was a royal or divine family. There was the god who was the father, and the god who was the mother, and the god who was the son. It's the ancient Trinity. It's the ancient substitute Trinity for the true biblical Trinity. Well, here's another temple, and we don't even know what god this one belonged to because they didn't find any inscriptions there, so they just call it Temple Z. And here's the really biggie. Here's the big one. If any of you can read this measurement rule down here, that's 100 meters or 100 yards. This is the Temple of Marduk, right at the center of the city of ancient Babylon. Marduk was the city god of Babylon, the national god of Babylon, and the personal god of Nebuchadnezzar. Now, the reason why they have only excavated the left half, this is a top plan, you're looking down on the broken walls, is because the other part is underwater. The water table at Babylon is fairly high. And to excavate the other part, you'd have to pump all that water out. It would be a very difficult job. You'll notice at the center of the left end, where it says the letter C, there are two big rooms. Those big rooms for the worth for the god Marduk. But the little rooms along the side were for the lesser gods, and they came there once a year. This is the Babylonian Hilton for the gods. They came at the time of the New Year's festival. They came on boats up and down the Euphrates River, and they took the statues off the boats. And then they marched through the processional way, and they marched to the temple, and they installed the gods in these rooms. And they stayed there for a week or 10 days till the New Year's festival was over, and then they went back in procession to their boats, and they went back to their own cities. The Babylonian New Year. In fact, if you read the book of Isaiah, he mocks this festival. He has cynical humor about the foolishness of an idol. And so Daniel undoubtedly thought the same. Well, here's Marduk. He's the god standing there, and it looks like he has kind of a kilt on or a flounce skirt or something like that. Then he has the insignia of his divinity. And then you'll see the dragon. The dragon that he is standing on its back or riding on its back. And that is the dragon that I showed you before that is a composite that is made up of different features. And so the particular feature here is the horned viper, the serpent. Right next to the great temple of Marduk was the temple tower. Temple of Marduk was built flat on the ground. But then they built a great temple tower. It actually had, this is a model. This is a model at the University of Chicago. And if you count them, you'll get to 7 stories. This is not a hollow building. This is a solid block. It's built out of bricks. Totally solid. But you would climb up the steps to the temple, which is on the very top. There is one building here, and it's the one on the top. And so the worship of the god Marduk was carried on in that very top temple tower. The very top of the tower, which is a temple. The temple of the god Marduk. Now, the interesting thing here is, the Babylonians had a name for this temple tower, for this particular temple tower. And the name was the temple which lifts its head up to heaven. Now, you might think a little bit about that and say, is there any echo of anything like that in the Scriptures? And there is, isn't there? The Tower of Babel. And so the theology of the Tower of Babel is found in the name of the temple they built there. But the sad thing is, if you go to Babylon today as a tourist, you won't see the Tower of Babel. Because Alexander the Great, when he conquered this area, as he marched east all the way to India, he wanted his engineers to rebuild this temple. It had fallen down. It was in ruins. He wanted his engineers to rebuild this temple. So he left orders for his engineers to clear all the bricks away and get ready to build the new temple. But then when he came back from his tour of India and he came back to Babylon, this is where he died. And that is why this temple was never rebuilt. So when you go to look at the temple today, all you see is a flat platform and there's a little bit of a moat around it. And the bricks from the building are in piles, some of them half mile, quarter mile away. It's as if there was a divine sentence on Alexander and on this temple. And so you don't see this. This is derived from an ancient text. This model is derived from an ancient text which gives the measurements around the temple of the different floors. And it also tells us that this ancient temple had enameled bricks, like you've seen with the animals, of different colors. And so one stage was red and yellow and blue and green and black and white. And so it must have been magnificent to see. And of course, this stood up way above all the rest of the city of Babylon. So Daniel, when he prays toward Jerusalem to the west, he could look to the right, to the north, and see the temple of Marduk. But he knows that the place where the true God, where the name of the true God dwelt, was in Jerusalem, not in Babylon and not in the Tower of Marduk or not in the Temple of Marduk. Well, here is an actual temple tower that does exist. In fact, it's in better shape than this now. This is the way the temple tower at Ur, the city of Ur, where Abraham lived for a time. And this is the temple tower as it looked in 1929 when the British were working there. Now, it has since been repaired by the Department of Antiquities, so it's in even better shape and gives you a better representation. Here's a picture of a king. And he's a famous king. You might have heard his name. His name is Hammurabi. Hammurabi. And he is famous especially for a law code. And this is the top of the stela on which this was carved. Stands about 5 or 6 feet high. And this is the top. This is a picture of the top. And on the right-hand side, you see Hammurabi. And on the left-hand side, you see Shamash, the god of the sun, who is also the god of justice. And he is endowing Hammurabi with the symbols of his kingship and with justice, so that he might be a just king to rule the land. Now, the conception of the Babylonians was the sun god. He had two jobs. He was a double dipper. His daytime job was to go through the heavens and shed light on the earth. But his nighttime job, when he was down in the underworld, when the sun didn't shine, he was supposed to hold court down there. And so that's when Shamash, the sun god, dispensed justice. So that's why he's the god of justice, and he's giving the keys of justice to Hammurabi, the king who wrote these laws. Here's a brick. I mentioned the hundreds of thousands of bricks of ancient Babylon that were inscribed with the name of Nebuchadnezzar, and here's one of them was stamped. They had a stamp, and they just stamped that. They didn't write each little letter. They just stamped these bricks like an assembly line. And then there's two ways to make bricks. One is sun-dried, and one is kiln-dried, which you fire in a kiln with a much higher temperature. And the kiln-dried bricks are harder. And so they would put the soft bricks in the center of, like, the temple tower, and they would put the fired enamel bricks on the outside of the buildings. This is a very famous tablet. Those of you who were in the Daniel class this morning, I read a couple of passages from this tablet. It's the tablet which tells about Nebuchadnezzar's conquest of the city of Jerusalem in the year 597. And this is an inscription from Cyrus. Now, you remember we talked a little bit about the story of Cyrus and how his troops conquered the city of Babylon. And he commemorated it, he celebrated it, by having this, what is called, it's actually round. It's a clay barrel. It's a clay barrel with all this cuneiform writing, and it tells about how the gods gave the city of Babylon to Cyrus. And there's a sense in which that's more true than he knew. And so this was the liberation. This king brought with him the liberation for the Jews who had gone into exile in Babylon. And so the life of Daniel spanned that 70 years from the time of Nebuchadnezzar. Here's the time of Nebuchadnezzar when Daniel went into captivity. And here's the time of Cyrus when the people of God went back to Judah 70 years later. Now there's one final picture here. I'm sorry you can't see it too well. It's a mystery. You know, it's always nice to whet your appetite a little bit. This statue is a mystery. Now you might study it a little bit and see what you see. And if you look carefully, in a little darker light, you might see a lion. And there's a lion up on top. And if you look a little more carefully, you might look at something underneath the lion. You see it? There's a man. His head is to the left and his feet are to the right. This lion is standing over this man. Now, this statue is a mystery. Archaeologists don't know where it came from. It doesn't have any inscription on it, but it raises an interesting question. What possibly could this represent? Now notice what the lion is doing. He's not chewing on this man. He's not eating him up. He's not scratching him to pieces. He is standing over him as if he were protecting him. So it is not an unreasonable suggestion that this might be, I wish I could prove it, this might be a statue of the lion preserving the ancient, aged man Daniel in the lion's den, and the lion stands there to protect him, not to devour him. So archaeologists have suggested, well, this may be a statue which the Babylonian troops brought back from one of their campaigns abroad. Well, maybe it was a commission of Cyrus or Darius the Mede to commemorate the famous event which happened in Daniel chapter 6, which is the story of Daniel in the lion's den. So we leave you with a puzzle, and you can puzzle that over yourselves, and tomorrow we'll look at another puzzle, and the puzzle that we'll look at tomorrow will be Sodom and Gomorrah. So if you want to do a little homework, you can read Genesis chapter 14 through chapter 19, because we'll look and see what the archaeologists have found in terms of things that might shed some light on Sodom and Gomorrah. Well, have a pleasant... Yes, questions. All right, we have 5 minutes for questions. It's right in the middle of the palace courtyard. As you come in the main north gate, the processional way, the Ishtar gate, you go down, you turn right or left, depending on the direction you come from. You go into the palace area. The palace was a Mediterranean-style set of buildings. There was a central courtyard. And this statue stands right in the middle of that central courtyard of the palace. So that could give a little more emphasis to the idea that it might be Daniel. Any other questions? Yes? Yes, that's correct. I may have misspoken, but Babylon is on the Euphrates River in the country of Iraq. The Medes lived in the mountains of northern Iran. So let me keep the two straight. The Medes in northern Persia. The Medes lived in the north and the Persians lived in the south, both in the country of Iran. West of that is what we call Mesopotamia, the river, the plain of the two rivers, Nineveh and Assyria in the north and Babylon in the south. You're quite right. Anybody else? You're all ready for dinner. Okay. We'll dismiss then.
You have been listening to another special American Cassette Ministries presentation.